God's timing is always perfect. As we know, it's the Kairos time for Samuel to be here today, just for Jane on her journey this year, clearly. A year ago, we had this series of topical sermons in place during August, and COVID intervened, lockdown, and we had to cancel Samuel's trip down from Wellington at the time, and so we put the whole thing on hold. So we were determined that we were going to have Sam down this year. It's a real joy to be able to welcome Sam. He's been somebody in our network, a friend for probably around 20 years since Carol and I first went to the Auckland Baptist Tabernacle on staff there. Sam was one of the young adult leaders. He was part of the upfront music. He's a pianist and a songwriter. Back in the early 2000s, we were singing Sam's Tireo song at the time, very, very frequently. I haven't sung it for years, Sam, but it was sort of, you know, something that was very much part of the heart of the church at that stage. So part of, I guess, my early awakening on my own treaty journey. So it's great, Sam, that you're down here. It's a real shame that Sam is also a really good friend of Steph and Murray Wood, and they are in Dunedin today because Adelaide has a gym competition. So they're going to miss out on seeing him. But just to introduce a bit about Sam, he's a lawyer and a historian. So I don't think Alison's here this morning, but she and I, as the only other lawyers in the congregation, really welcome you, Sam, as somebody with a legal brain, which is good. Primarily, though, a historian. He's also the husband to Hannah and father to four children. Samuel really loves history, as you'll discover, especially New Zealand history. And it saw him leave legal practice and head off and do a master's, an MA, which then led him on to work as a historian with the Waitangi Tribunal. I think that's followed by some work with the Office of Treaty Settlements, the Crown Law Office, and the Office for Māori Crown Relations. So a lot of work in the central government area there around treaty relationships. His PhD completed last year focused on the reshaping of ideas around political community and authority in the 19th century Māori and European worlds. So historian in action. The start of this year, Sam and family relocated to Auckland with his appointment as a research and professional teaching fellow at Laidlaw College. They are living at St. John's College, where he's also a residential scholar. So, gosh, the whole world of academia opening up for you, isn't it? It's fantastic. But in 2000, and part of the reason, I guess, that I was really keen that Sam was here, Sam, with a small group, began an annual pilgrimage to Waitangi to engage with the treaty celebrations and try and understand some of the whys of our history as a nation. And this was a practice which grew year by year by year and led to the formation of Karufa Trust, of which Sam is one of the founding trustees, I think in around 2005. And that trust continues to facilitate pilgrimages to Waitangi, but it also fosters conversations around identity and history to help people know the story that we are part of. So it's with that background that Sam, who's also a really nice guy too, despite all of that stuff, is going to come and talk to us this morning. And there's going to be an opportunity to engage with him a little bit later on, but Jane will introduce how that's going to happen. So Sam, welcome to Ireland. It's lovely to have you here.
Just remove this and smooth out the beard. Always a problem. Tēnā tātou katoa, ka mihi nui ki te kaihanga o ngā mea katoa. Just acknowledge the creator of all things. te mihi hoki ki a rātou, kua whiturangi tia. Acknowledge those who have passed on before us and have sort of carried the faith. Those who are adorned as the stars. As the Māori language says. Tēnā kōrua, te whare e tūnei, te whenua e takoto rā, tēnā kōrua. Just acknowledge the whare the house here that we're in and the land. Ka nui a tamihi ki te tangata whenua o konei, o tēnei wāhi kaitahu me ngā hapū katoa, iwi katoa o te whenua nei. I just acknowledge the people of the land, those who have sort of carried the history of the land for many centuries and have also carried their search for justice in colonial times through to the present, really. So acknowledge them and their leaders, the likes of Sir Tipene or Reagan, one of my colleagues in history, Michael Stevens, who's a great up-and-coming scholar, well, he's almost an established scholar of history of this part of the world. So I definitely encourage you to read his stuff, Michael Stevens. Ko pukeko e te maunga, ko Waikato te awa, ko Ngāti Pākehā te iwi, ko Bombay te waka. My ancestors arrived from Cornwall and other places in the 19th century. The Cornish ones settled in around Pukekohe, which is where I grew up. Thank you, Peter, for your welcome today. That was a brilliant introduction. I couldn't have summarised my CV any better in conciser fashion than that. So, really great to be here with you today and share some stories, share some thoughts, some reflections on what is a pretty massive topic. It's a little bit dark up there, isn't it? That's all right, it should be readable. So it should be obvious that this... I'm not actually going to speak too much about the treaty today, ironically, but really, I guess, set a bit more of the wider context into which the treaty was entered into. So I want to talk about this very big topic of Christianity and colonisation. Such a huge and important question. So many different ways to narrate this history. What I'm hoping to do is sort of break down this big topic into a couple of, or a few smaller component questions to make the analysis more manageable, then to consider a few responses that we might make to this history in the present day, which I'm calling rather ambitiously a manifesto, a Christian manifesto for action, if you like. So this is, I guess, material that is constantly a work in progress, and no doubt if I come back in 5 years, I'll probably say something completely different. But here we go. So just make sure this works. Seems to be struggling, the clicker. Oh, there we go. Okay. So what was going on here in Aotearoa and elsewhere? I'm focused here on missionary Christianity rather than settler Christianity, which is a somewhat different kettle of fish and a somewhat different story. But I want to ask this question to begin. Did Christians support or oppose colonial expansion? This is like the institutional political question. And I'll come to the cultural question in a minute. In reality, the political picture is a diverse patchwork of imperial institutions interacting with mission agencies, traders, settlers, other non-government lobby groups, such as the Aborigines Protection Society that was birthed in the 1830s out of the anti-slavery movement. The fact is that sometimes missionaries preceded empire, sometimes they followed empire. Sometimes missionaries or churches opposed imperial policy, sometimes they supported it, and sometimes they were, I suppose, neutral. Now these debates are ongoing in our present through episodes or movements such as Black Lives Matter, debates about a European doctrine of discovery, and debates about the content of a New Zealand history curriculum for schools. And I'm not going to get into any of those really today. So what I want to focus on is this missions and empire story for a few minutes. The relationship between is there a technique to this? Yeah, just forward. So this is a variable picture. As Andrew Porter writes, Christianity's expansion as part of British culture and activities overseas in the 19th century was unprecedented in scale. Anglicans, Presbyterians, Roman Catholics and other denominations recreated their churches overseas, adapted them to new environments in the process. In a parallel movement, driven especially by voluntary Protestant missionary societies founded in the 1790s, evangelical Christians and the missionaries they supported overseas, some 10,000 by 1900, set out to convert the extra-European world. There was, however, no simple connection between this religious expansion and a specifically British influence or empire overseas. So what was the relationship? What was the context of this missionary movement? There was a lot going on in the 1790s, including the French Revolutionary Wars. Most of the early missionaries were evangelicals, Methodists, and the like, lower middling class upbringings. An Anglican cleric, Sidney Smith, who I guess was part of the establishment, infamously caricatured missionaries in a leading periodical. He said, "If a tinker is a devout man, he infallibly sets off for the East." And he also suggested that Baptist missionaries were, quote, "benefiting us much more by their absence." What he failed to realise is that many of the early missionaries and founders of missionary societies were in fact well educated for their time. The founders listed the London Missionary Society, for example, boasted several doctorates. William Carey was, of course, from the artisan class, but became one of the most celebrated translators of scripture and other texts. And into multiple languages. It's a remarkable story. What I want to do is consider perhaps two or three representative stories in this picture and wider process of missions and empire. What I've highlighted there is some of the earlier in the previous slide. I'm not sure if this is working for me. Some of the earliest mission stations that were settlements that were established from the very late 1700s, early 1800s, and many different mission societies. There's about 10 listed on that map. Next slide. So, Bishop Selwyn's story for a moment. Bishop George Augustus Selwyn was New Zealand's first colonial bishop in the Anglican system. He was later grouped among those 19th century muscular Christians, actively engaged in missions and just simply active. He was a swimmer from his Cambridge University days. He rode in the first Cambridge-Oxford boat race. He once walked to London in 13 hours. Now, I'm not sure if that story is apocryphal. I checked on Google Maps and it says it takes 17 and three-quarter hours to walk from Cambridge to London these days, so. But perhaps that's possible. He used a stand-up writing desk, which actually remained standing in the corner of the old dining room at St. John's College, which I'm now living, established in 1846. So he was ahead of his time, he stand-up writing desk. It is possible that Selwyn's active and engaged temperament was also his but was his greatest asset in a strenuous colonial context. These are his missionary journeys only from the 1840s, of course, mostly by sea. His greatest asset, but in a sense perhaps his greatest downfall. He may have at times rushed in where angels feared to tread. He was no fool, but perhaps his biggest error of judgment was to ride with the troops during the Waikato campaign in the 1860s. And he was there, as he saw it, to assist the dying and wounded on both sides. That was his Christian duty. However, this picture of Samoan riding with the troops into the Waikato became imprinted in many Māori minds and was misrepresented or misunderstood as Samoan, I guess, being a mere lackey of the imperial military authorities. And this caused him much grief with Māori. He wrote mournfully to England in 1865 that his role in the Waikato campaign had, quote, destroyed my influence with many. This is another quote. When instead of a nation of believers welcoming me as their father, I find here and there a few scattered sheep, the remnants of a flock which has forsaken the shepherd. I'll come back to that point in a minute. Samoan also had great insight into the possibilities of colonial and indigenous governance. He advocated for the kingitanga, the king movement, as a separate province, in effect, of the provincial government system. And he saw this as reconciling the unity of law with the duality of mana, which is a fascinating phrase that could be unpacked. The unity of law is in there's sort of one legal system, but there are different authorities within that system, the duality of mana, one mana being the king movement. So in this, perhaps, he was one of the first Pākehā advocates of something we now call, in 2022, co-governance. So Samoan in this 1865 lament that I quoted was not just reflecting on his role, but also the effects of the New Zealand Wars generally on Māori Christianity, which was, in many ways, a widespread loss of faith. Octavius Hadfield, who was, next slide, who was chief missionary on the Kapiti Coast, was in no doubt of the effects of the wars on Māori perceptions of European Christianity. Next slide. Maybe that's not the next slide. Sorry, back. He said that early in 1860, several intelligent natives warned me that this war would prove a sad trial for the faith of the Māori, that they had carefully examined the New Testament from beginning to end, and nothing contained in it could be interpreted to sanction or justify such a war, that either the English nation, as represented by its government, was not Christian in the gospel sense, or Christianity was not true. There was no alternative. I'll just read that last bit again. That either the English nation, as represented by its government, was not Christian in the gospel sense, or Christianity was not true. There was no alternative. But on the Māori side, it is interesting to see the ways in which Christianity in Scripture shaped and fueled a critique of the settler colonial state. This is in some ways a complex story, but it's revealed in a well-publicised speech by a senior Māori rangatira of Hawke's Bay in the early 1860s, in which he was critiquing the government's handling of the Waitara purchase in Taranaki. And this is what he stated in that speech. Now my duty to that mother of mine, the Queen, is ended, unless she will look upon the fault of this governor who feeds us with guns, powder and ball, and recall him, and give me a governor who will feed me with digestible food, with councils, with courts of justice, with love, and with good deeds. So this language of councils and lawful investigations coupled with the language of aroha clearly reflects Christian teaching. The tragedy, of course, is that having taught Māori that they should turn to both gospel and law, rather than resolving their disputes by warfare or utu, that a supposedly Christian government should come along later and exact warfare against them and confiscate the land, no less. So that's the real tragedy in this story. My third, I guess, representative story, well, it's a story from this period, which sees, I guess, missions arrayed against settler colonial authorities, is the story of the Caribbean slave rebellions in the 1820s and 30s. The Christmas Rebellion, or the Great Jamaica Slave Revolt of 1831-32, was also known as the Baptist War. I'm trying to give you a bit of a Baptist narrative today, as you can see, because it was led by the missionary-educated slave and Baptist preacher Samuel Sharp. So this was an African man, Samuel Sharp. It involved up to 60,000 of the 300,000 slaves in the Jamaican colony. And their hopes were linked to the emancipation campaigns in the UK. They were demanding, obviously, more freedom, increased better conditions, increased wages. So there was an uprising that was suppressed by the British military. The planters themselves exacted more brutal justice against some 500 slaves. Chapels were destroyed. Some white missionaries were physically assaulted. And this the Samuel Sharp was pastored in the earlier period by Thomas Birchall, who was a leading Baptist missionary and slavery abolitionist. Birchall is quite a common name in Jamaica today. I guess African Jamaican parents name their children. So in the earlier Demerara slave rebellion, which was a decade earlier in 1823, the LMS missionary John Smith had died in prison following conviction by settler authorities for fostering the rebellion, although he'd also urged those revolting to avoid violence wherever possible. His wife, Jane, was refused, John and Jane, it's a great English name, John and Jane Smith. His wife, Jane, was refused admission even to his burial. So his treatment by the white planter authorities helped to fuel the slavery abolition cause in the United Kingdom. And William Wilberforce in the Commons, in his last speech to the Commons, referred to Smith. So Andrew Porter says that, wakened in the morning to the sounds of slaves being flogged, realising gradually that with few exceptions, his only sources of friendship, warmth and happiness were the slaves, he found his abolitionist inclinations confirmed. So the Caribbean colonies, more even than other places, impressed on missionaries the impossibility of detachment from politics and government, that brought home to them the necessity of cultivating both secular authority as a vital aid to their undertakings and the popular opinion needed at times to compel authorities to act in their defence. That is, in defence of the slaves. So sometimes Christians, missionaries, use the imperial state apparatus against colonial authority. I know that's a bit of a strange sort of paradox, but it's a true one. So the British Navy, for example, was, you know, enrolled in policing the Atlantic to intercept slave trading ships. So leaving to one side now this politics story, I want to turn to a story which is in some ways more complex, and that's Christianity's role in colonialism generally. And this is an issue that again could be approached from so many vantage points and perspectives and experiences. So I just want to ask this question though, what is culture anyway? This is something I think about quite a lot as a historian who's interested in ideas and who's sort of attracted to sort of anthropological understandings of history. But the anthropologists have actually done a really good job at multiplying definitions of culture, because an eminent cultural anthropologist, Clifford Geertz, he once wrote about how he turned up to Harvard in the 1950s at just the moment when senior members of the faculty were compiling from the literature all definitions of culture. Okay, culture. The final list comprised 171 definitions in 13 categories. I guess I like understandings of culture that emphasise the frames of reference, the symbols or ideas that give meaning to our existence. The French, one French word for this is mentalities. And so I want to explore two different ideas here, the gospel through culture and the gospel beyond culture. I think it's quite obvious if we sit back and think about it that the good news, the gospel, is always expressed and given institutional form, including the form we find ourselves in today, only in human cultures. And Jesus himself became a human. He was born into a Jewish culture in the wider political context of the Roman Empire. The death he died was the death of a slave. But it's a death, of course, that Christians see as far more significant. So in New Zealand, Christian faith and practice was expressed in different ways in the early missionary period. There was chapel building, baptisms only after catechising in the Anglican system, Sabbath practice, morning and evening prayer using the Book of Common Prayer, new songs and sounds in the land, music and hymns, sometimes using the organ, education and literacy in scripture, church and European history, peacemaking or mediation in tribal conflicts, the teaching of agriculture and trade skills, including boat building. Now, this list of things really represents, I suppose, a kind of cultural revolution in Māori society. And so we kind of ask the question, what aspects were vital to the spread of the Christian faith in Aotearoa, or were some expendable? Could we have done away with some of them? Well, no doubt in theory, probably some of them could have been done away with, right? Arguably, though, they were basic transpositions of Christian practices from the home country, or necessary responses to the context of the time, including the extensive practice of agriculture, which was for survival as much as teaching the arts of civilization, as Samuel Marsden called them. The most cultural aspect, perhaps, is besides the English chapel, was the organ. However, the organ, in a sense, was so integral to English Christianity that in some ways it was probably unimaginable without it, as we might sort of almost be able to not imagine a church service today without these things over here, these instruments. I'm sure we can, but... but if we're thinking of the gospel expressed through cultural modes and practices, we should also be able to discern, I think, the gospel beyond culture. The expressions of human generosity and love compelled by the Spirit that transcended culture and even doctrine. One example of this, which may seem unremarkable at first glance, is Henry Williams' interactions with a Māori tohunga, or priest, on one occasion. Henry Williams, of course, was one of the leading early missionaries in New Zealand. Tohutapu looms large as a figure in early Williams' journals and correspondence. An early episode saw an angry standoff at the Paihia mission, in which the missionary woman and children were sort of huddled inside the whare. But after Henry and others had won the trust of Tohutapu, the relationship went along more smoothly, And Tohutapu possibly grew to appreciate the missionaries and the message they stood for. On a later occasion, Henry recorded how Tohutapu had returned from a journey to find that both his wives had been unfaithful. Now, he was very downcast about this, and Henry recorded that at first he meant to hang himself, then he thought to take the life of another person as payment, or utu, but was restrained, he said, by the missionaries. He expressed his wish to die and refused to eat. And Williams recorded, "I could not but feel considerably for him. I spoke to him for some time and left him." And this little episode, I think, is an example of the bonds of friendship and feeling that could grow up between people across quite a wide cultural divide. As it happened, Tohutapu was encouraged enough not to take his own life nor that of somebody else in payment for the insults to his mana, and he remained an essential friend of the mission over some years. Another little story is that, and I think this is one of my favourite, I think the most significant quotes that I've come across in recent times. It's often a conventional to see the influence of the missionaries on Māori society, but not the other way around. The influence of Māori language on missionary thinking and practice. So Bishop Salwyn, again, going back to the bishop, and he addressed Waikato tribes in a speech in 1862. He used some remarkable language, and I'll read this. It's a slightly extended quote. He said, "Here I am, the mediator of New Zealand." He was imploring unity with the colonial authorities at this point, trying to prevent war, essentially. "This is my work, mediation. I am not a Pākehā, neither am I a Māori. I am a half-caste. I have eaten your food, I have slept in your houses. We have eaten together, talked together, travelled together, prayed together, and partaken of the Lord's Supper together. And therefore I tell you that I am a half-caste. My being a half-caste cannot be altered or uprooted. It is in my body, in my flesh, in my sinews, in my bones, and in my marrow." He goes on. "Hence I say to you, we are all half-castes, and therefore let us live together in one religion or faith, one love and one law." Of course, this was a speech in Māori, so that's a translation of it. I think this is quite a profound message about cultural intermingling and identity, saying that Māori and Pākehā were brothers and equals in practice, and not just in theory, because they'd worshipped together, they'd eaten together, they'd slept in the same whare, to such an extent that each had become half-caste. Now, that phraseology in our 21st century New Zealand is very sort of passé, but I think we should see the profundity of it in 1862, that each party had been shaped by interactions with the other, that the cultural influence was two-way, not one-way. It was mutual. It was dynamic. So, after this little excursion into history in the 19th century, I turn now to us here in Aotearoa in the 21st century for a few minutes. In light of these stories, of this analysis, how do we navigate and reconcile our complex, entangled, and interwoven histories? Firstly, we need to discover how to narrate our story or stories in a multitude of different ways. Their richness and complexity. Their tragedy and their pain, their beauty and their goodness, their hate and their love, their inhumanity and their humanity. Yeah, our histories are interwoven, but the way we reconstruct this interweaving, I think, in a sense, is the most important part, to give balance to the different experiences of the past, different perspectives on the past. I've sort of put a bit of a glaze over those images to sort of represent visually that the way we're sort of re-narrating our past, I think, is only emerging, in our current context. Secondly, it's about honouring the treaty relationship. I couldn't give this talk without mentioning the treaty at least once. So, tangata whenua, the relationship between tangata whenua, people of the land, and tangata te tiriti, those here by right of the treaty, which is a concept that Sir Eddie Jury came up with, I believe. This is a really useful way, more than a useful way, of thinking about the way we belong to this land, because it honours the history and the covenant made at Waitangi. It defines, I think, more by recognising the customary authorities and groups in the land rather than a sort of an ethnic definition. It's about acknowledging Māori as tangata whenua, as exercising customary authority, tino rangatiratanga, while there is this other authority called Crown Kāwanatanga or governance. How do those two things sort of, interrelate? So in reality, of course, our identities are more complex than simply ethnicity or genealogy even. They're shaped by our lived experience, by the living cultures that I guess I've touched on, by our affiliations with groups and with hapu, with churches. Thirdly, restoring land and relationships. When I reflect on it, I see that the treaty settlement process we've been through over the last sort of 30, almost 40 years now, assumes a basically Christian framework of acknowledging wrong, apologising for the wrong, and making some restitution. Obviously not 100% compensation, but some restitution. Now the church, or particular churches, have also their own stories within this wider colonial narrative. Older denominations, including the Anglicans, have begun to investigate how they came to own the land that they do today. Even if churches were not involved in original dispossession, what are the ways that relationships with local hapu and iwi can be restored or established anew? Now, this might involve some restitution of property in some cases. In my view, this should come out of intentional and meaningful relating to iwi. It's not just a case of handing stuff back. There may be opportunities instead for community partnerships, for symbolic gift and gifting back, of gifting and leasing back, or projects of local storytelling in which iwi stories and local church and settler stories are woven together. You may have heard of the recent church in Tauranga that's decided to give some of its property in the central isthmus of Tauranga back to local hapu. That's one example. And lastly, I have this phrase called deep hanging out. And I borrowed this phrase from another cultural anthropologist who was describing their methodology of being amongst and learning from another culture. It seems to me to describe an appropriate practice of Christians in cross-cultural contexts, or any context where we're sort of crossing boundaries, real or imagined. It has been my experience in Christian service that good things take time. That goes for real learning as it does for meaningful relationship. And I'll just briefly mention Karewha Trust. Although it began only as an annual pilgrimage to Waitangi over February commemorations, we continued to return over the years to the point that we've been embraced by the haukainga, the home people, as part of the fabric of organising and hosting the event at Waitangi. That is to say, we do service stuff in various ways, including helping out in the kitchen, which is sort of like the heart of, I guess, where that kind of service mahi started. So we don't see this as something that we've earned, though. It's not something to be taken for granted. Rather, it's the expression of a relationship that has its roots in a much longer relationship between missionaries and Māori in the Bay of Islands. So our journey of deep hanging out, of deep fellowship or brotherhood, sisterhood, of human unity and solidarity, we trust, has only begun. Kia ora tātou katoa.